Welcome to Rebel Tales Podcast. I'm your host, Dwayne Crowley. So this has been a project that I've had in my head for a long time now. And anyone who knows me will be sick of hearing me speak about Irish history at any and all opportunity. So I'm here for a new audience to bear the burden of listening to me. My first time doing a podcast, so I'm sure we'll figure this out as we go along. But the main reason that I'm starting this podcast is to keep the memory of those ordinary men and women of Ireland who risked everything for the freedom of Ireland alive. The stories that I'll tell are of incredible bravery of the people who stood before the Empire and refused to be serf or subject any longer. When they took action, they weren't assured of victory. In the mix of rebels of all abilities, men with pikes and later rusty shotguns and old rifles took on the well-armed and well-trained agents of the Crown that were sent to keep the nation on its knees. Regardless of how the story is told and from what perspective it's told, it's important for us to still hear what those people had to say, to take things from their perspective, to try and understand why they thought what they thought, why they did what they did. Throughout this podcast, I'm going to be very, very mindful of not taking a side. We'll talk about, for instance, the Civil War from 1922 to 1923, and even the treaty negotiations of December 1921. I don't want to take the pro-treaty side or the anti-treaty side. I don't want to influence any kind of bias in anybody. I just want to bring those stories to life so that we can all take an educated guess at how we feel about things. Today, I just want to give a taste of things to come throughout this podcast series. What I want to do is read from books or read from testimonies given to the Bureau of Military History in Ireland, or read other survivors' testimonies. And really, like I was saying, take it from the people who were there. And not that we're going to take their word as gospel, that it was truth, but it was from their perspective. So to start, we're going to start today with one of the main characters of the 1916 Rising, Padraic Pearse. In future podcasts, we're going to dig deeper into his life and what he did and what he stood for. But I want to read today the graveside oration that he gave at the great Fenian O'Donovan Ross's funeral in 1915. To many, this was seen as the speech that started the rising. It was a call to action for those who are willing to carry the fight for Irish freedom to the flag. Now, Padraic Pearse was a very complicated character. He was, like I was saying, a leader of the 1916 Rising, and he served as Commander-in-Chief and President of the Republic of Ireland, that he declared on the steps of the GPO by reading the proclamation of the Republic that he wrote. But also you can see heavy influences of James Connolly's teachings in it too. And again, we'll cover that in the later podcast. When the fighting was over, Pearse agreed to surrender to stop the killing of innocent people. It had gone on too long, and they knew that there was no real hope of winning. Now, depending on the story that you hear, the leaders of the rebellion were waiting for 30,000 German troops to come to Dublin to help them, because as they saw it at the time, when England was at war, in the Great War, World War One, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And they, even in the proclamation, mentioned their gallant allies in Europe. So when it was clear that the Germans weren't coming, things were looking fairly bleak. One of the other main beliefs that they had too, and this came from James Connolly, who, heavily communist and socialist in his beliefs, he believed that capitalists wouldn't destroy capital. But then the shelling started and the cannons destroyed the big buildings that all of the rebels had taken up station in the heart of Dublin. So anyway, I'm going to keep saying it because today is only an intro, but we're going to go into this in an awful lot of detail in future podcasts. But Pierre surrendered. He was imprisoned and he was sentenced to death without trial. Many believed that the rising was always going to end in a blood sacrifice for Pierce. He was a devout Catholic, and when you think about it, the symbolism of planning to start the rebellion on Easter Sunday, it was no coincidence, even though it started on Easter Monday for reasons that we'll go into, but not today. But Pierce said of the First World War, "The old heart of the earth needed to be warmed with the red wine of the battlefields. Such august homage was never before offered to God as this, the homage of millions of lives given gladly for love of country." That's powerful. That gives you an insight into his thoughts of war and human sacrifice, blood sacrifice, that he believed that only true death and only through sacrifice could the martyrs cause the resurrection of the Irish Republic, to give it a sort of poetic turn of phrase. And Pierce was a poet. I've got a collection of his books here that were published in 1924. I'm going to read from one of them here in a minute. And some of his poetry was absolutely beautiful, but really, really powerful. But his speeches were really something else. He was also a teacher, and he was a barrister. He was an educated man, but above all, he was devout in his love of country. So there's an awful lot to unpack there in future episodes. So now I'm going to read the oration he gave at the graveside of O'Donovan Rossa. Oration at the graveside of Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa. It has seemed right, before we turn away from this place in which we have laid the mortal remains of O'Donovan Rossa, that one among us should, in the name of all, speak the praise of that valiant man, and endeavour to formulate the thought and the hope that are in us as we stand around his grave. And if there is anything that makes it fitting that I, rather than one of the grey-haired men who were young with him and shared in his labour and in his suffering, should speak here, it is perhaps that I may be taken as speaking on behalf of a new generation that has been re-baptised in the Fenian faith, and that has accepted the responsibility of carrying out the Fenian programme. I propose to you, then, that here, by the grave of this unrepentant Fenian, we renew our baptismal vows. That here, by the grave of this unconquered and unconquerable man, we ask of God, each one for himself, such unshakable purpose, such high and gallant courage, such unbreakable strength of soul as belonged to O'Donovan Rossa. Deliberately here we avow ourselves, as he avowed himself in the dock, Irishmen of one allegiance only. We of the Irish Volunteers, and you others who are associated with us in today's task and duty, are bound together and must stand together henceforth in brotherly union for the achievement of the freedom of Ireland. And we know only one definition of freedom. It is Tone's definition. It is Mitchell's definition. It is Ross's definition. Let no man blaspheme the cause that the dead generations of Ireland served by giving it any other name and definition than their name and their definition. We stand at Ross's grave not in sadness, but rather an exaltation of spirit that it has been given to us to come thus into so close a communion with that brave and splendid Gael. Splendid and holy causes are served by men who are themselves splendid and holy. O'Donovan Rossa was splendid in the proud manhood of him, splendid in the heroic grace of him, splendid in the Gaelic strength and clarity and truth of him. And all that splendour and pride and strength was compatible with a humility and a simplicity of devotion to Ireland, to all that was olden and beautiful and Gaelic in Ireland, the holiness and simplicity of patriotism of a Michael O'Clery, of an Owen O'Groney. The clear true eyes of this man, almost alone in his day, visioned Ireland as we of today would surely have her. Not merely free, but Gaelic as well. Not Gaelic merely, but free as well. In closer spiritual communion with him now than ever before, or perhaps ever again, in a spiritual communion with those of his day, living and dead, who suffered with him in English prisons, in communion of spirit too with our own dear comrades who suffer in English prisons today, And speaking on their behalf as well as our own, we pledge to Ireland our love, and we pledge to English rule in Ireland our hate. This is a place of peace, sacred to the dead, where men should speak with all charity and with all restraint. But I hold it a Christian thing, as O'Donovan Rossa held it, to hate evil, to hate untruth, to hate oppression, and hating them, to strive to overthrow them. Our foes are strong and wise and wary, but strong and wise and wary as they are, they cannot undo the miracles of God, who ripens in the heart of young men the seed sown by the young men of a former generation. And the seeds sown by the young men of 65 and 67 are coming to their miraculous ripening today. Rulers and defenders of realms had need to be wary if they would guard against such processes. Life springs from death, and from the graves of patriot men and women spring living nations. The defenders of this realm have worked in secret and in the open. They think that they have pacified Ireland. They think that they have purchased half of us and intimidated the other half. They think that they have foreseen everything. They think that they have provided against everything. But the fools, the fools, the fools. They have left us our Fenian dead. And while Ireland holds these graves, Ireland unfree shall never be at peace. So you can see that's incredibly powerful stuff, and how influential that would have been to the young generations who would have heard it, not only at the gravesite, but also read it in the papers, and how it would have been distributed throughout the volunteer networks at the time, and the Irish Citizen Army, I'd imagine. I had to give it a bit of theatrics there, which I'll try and do to bring some of these readings to life. But bear with me. It's one of the reasons I won't be on camera, I'd say. But, you know, they were powerful words that need to be brought to life somehow. I want to also cover in this podcast, as way of an introduction to the podcast, another reading taken from the book Guerrilla Days in Ireland, which was the memoir of Commandant General Tom Barry, who was a powerful figure during the War of Independence, leading the flying column to engage the British in many engagements in West Cork. They were the first to really take on the OGSEs, the Auxiliary Division of the Royal Irish Constabulary, in the Kilmichael ambush. Very, very controversial figure after the War of Independence, throughout the Civil War and beyond. For anybody in Cork, you might not be aware, but Tom Barry actually lived most of the later years of his life above the Blue MacDonald's, as those of us of a certain generation would know it as, on the Grand Parade, in an apartment up there. He died of old age in his 80s. I think he was 83. The Kilmichael ambush was a very, very important engagement in the War of Independence. The auxiliaries were brought in to basically back up the RIC, who were hemorrhaging members of Irishmen who didn't want to fight their own men. The British had brought in the Black and Tans, so named because of their off-colour uniforms. They were brought in so quick they didn't have time to create uniforms for them. But the Auxiliary Division were different. They were commissioned officers that were given a pound a day to come over and basically rain terror on the Irish. Their tales of incredible brutality and cruelty are too many to mention, but I will be going through hundreds of them on this podcast. But in this engagement, anyway, the men lay in ambush. They destroyed two Crossley tenders full of auxiliaries, and throughout the fight, there was something that was known as the false surrender, where Tom Barry claims that towards the later part of the engagement, three of the Auxies put up their hands and said, "I surrender," dropping their rifles, which brought some of the men in ambush positions out of cover. And as they did, those Auxies pulled their sidearms, their revolvers, and open-fired, killing, depending on the account, two to three of the volunteers. But even Tom Barry has different accounts of when those men died. There's some of the different survivors of Kilmichael talk about how it happened differently, but also Peter Hart, the late historian, I think he was Canadian, he published a book called The IRA and Its Enemies. And in that, he claims that there was no false surrender, that he, Tom Barry, ordered those men to open fire on those Oxys after they surrendered, and that they didn't pick up their sidearms and open fire on the volunteers. There's been a couple of books since. I know Eve Morrison published one on Kilmichael. There's another battlefield study of the Kilmichael ambush site by Sean. I'll have to get his name. I'm going to be covering the Kilmichael ambush in greater detail in the next podcast. But regardless of what happened, if there was a false surrender, if there wasn't a false surrender, the story still needs to be told of the men who were there from more perspectives than Tom's. But I do want to read a certain chapter here, which was the night before the Kilmichael ambush. It's page 71 of Guerrilla Days in Ireland, again published in 1949, and it's called, title of the chapter is March to Kilmichael, and I'm just going to read it because this gives a good insight into what happened the day before, what the men thought, what was going through their minds, how the ambush was set up, why the ambush was set up, and then next week I'm going to go through the ambush itself from different perspectives. Sir Hammer Greenwood, British Chief Secretary for Ireland, announced in the House of Commons in August 1920 that the RIC continued to resign, and that, in addition to those already departed, 560 others had walked out in the months of June and July. He also stated that his black and tans, made up of British ex-servicemen, were not only filling the gaps created by RIC resignations, but were actually doubling the 1918 strength of the RIC. He gave many assurances that in a few weeks the military, black and tans, and a new force called the Auxiliaries would wipe out in Ireland all resistance to British rule. 150 of this new force of auxiliaries arrived in Macroom in August 1920 and commandeered Macroom Castle as their barracks. Of all the ruthless forces that occupied Ireland through the centuries, those auxiliaries were surely the worst. They were recruited from ex-British officers who had held commissioned rank and had had active service on one or more fronts during the 1914 to 1918 war. They were openly established as a terrorist body, with the avowed object of breaking, by armed force, Ireland's continued resistance to British rule. Their war ranks ranged from lieutenant to brigadier general, and they were publicised as the very pick of Britain's best fighters. Highly paid, and with no bothersome discipline, they were habitual looters. They were even dressed in a special uniform calculated to cow their opponents. Each carried a rifle, two revolvers, one strapped to each thigh, and two Mills bombs hung at the waist from their Sam Brown belts. It should be said, in all fairness to the better type of British officers, that they had refused to join this force. Macroom was outside the West Cork IRA Brigade area, but the company of auxiliaries stationed there seemed to concentrate, from their time of arrival, on raiding south in their brigade area. Day after day they travelled into Coppin, Castletown Kenna, Dunmanway, and even south of the Bandon River. By November 1st, it seemed to me that they were working on a plan to eliminate IRA resistance by terrorism in one district at a time, and then move on to repeat their activities in some other area. They had a special technique. Fast lorries of them would come roaring into a village. The occupants would jump out, firing shots, and ordering all the inhabitants out of doors. No exceptions were made. Men and women, old and young, the sick and decrepit, were lined up against the walls with their hands up, questioned and searched. No raid was ever carried out by these ex-officers without their beating up with the butt ends of their revolvers at least a half dozen people. There were no respecters of persons, and seemed to particularly dislike the Catholic priests. Actually, in cold blood, they murdered the very aged, the aged, very reverend Canon Magnier, PP, Dunmanway, on one of their expeditions. For hours they would hold the little community's prisoners, and on one or more occasion, in different villages, they stripped all of the men naked in the presence of the assembled people of both sexes and beat them mercilessly with belts and rifles. They commandeered without payment food and drink, and they seldom returned sober to their barracks. Observing some man working at his bog or small field a few hundred yards from the road, they would stop their lorries and start their pleasant game, laughing and shouting,
Four or five would take aim, not to hit him, but to spatter the earth or bog around him. The man would run wildly, with the Xyz bullets clipping the sods all around him. He would stumble and fall, rise again, and continue to run for safety. But sometimes he would not rise, as an auxiliary bullet was sent through him to stop forever all his movements. Still laughing and joking, these gentlemen and officers would ride away. Why not? The corpse is only an Irish peasant, and probably a sympathiser with these rebels. And anyway, what did it matter? One more or less made no difference, and it was part of their duty to strike terror into the heart of all of the Irish. The auxiliary force had been allowed to bluster through the country for 4 or 5 months, killing, beating, terrorising, and burning factories and homes. Strange as it may appear, not a single shot had been fired at them up to this point by the IRA in any part of Ireland to halt their terror campaign. This fact had a very serious effect on the morale of the whole people as well as on the IRA. Stories were current that the Oxys were super fighters and all but invincible. There could be no further delay in challenging them. On November 21st, a column of 36 riflemen were mobilised at Farrells of Clogher, northwest of Dunmanway, for a week's training preparatory to opening the attacks on the super force. On that Sunday, a brigade meeting was held at Curraghdrina, and although many battalion OCs reported the assaults of auxiliaries in their districts, no mention was made that it was proposed to attack them on the following Sunday. After the meeting, I turned north to meet the new flying column. This unit was composed of new men, only one of whom had fought previously at Taurine, and only three had been to a training camp. They were mostly quite untrained, but many appeared to be splendid natural fighters. They looked a fine body of the best type of volunteers, and with some exceptions, lived up to this estimate afterwards. The column was divided into three sections, section commanders were appointed, and training started early on Monday morning. Training was interrupted three times by enemy military raiding parties who came so close that twice a fight was nearly forced in the IRA. The column had a definitive objective on the following Sunday and was not to be diverted, so it was moved on and evasive action was taken. Starting on Monday at Tauchar, it was 13 miles southeast of its first billets on its following Saturday when training was completed. On the Friday, accompanied by Michael McCarthy, Vice Commandant of the Dunmanway Battalion, I rode on horseback to select the ambush position. We returned to the flying column. That night, Paddy O'Brien had come to speak to me as I was pondering on the problem as to how best to ensure that the auxiliaries would slow down before the attack opened. Paddy was wearing a fine IRA officer's tunic. Suddenly, the thought came that the auxiliaries could never have seen a man wearing one of these. If, on coming into the ambush position, they were to see a man wearing such uniform, with an officer's field equipment such as I wore, they would be certain to slow down to investigate. Paddy O'Brien was told to change his tunic from my civilian coat for a couple of days. At 2 a.m. on Sunday, the flying column of 36 riflemen fell in at O'Sullivan's, Ahlina. Each man was armed with a rifle and 35 rounds. A few had revolvers, and the commander also had 2 Mills bombs, which had been captured at Taurine. At 3 a.m, the men were told for the first time that they were moving in to attack the auxiliaries between Macroom and Dunmanway. Father O'Connell, P.P. Ballinine, had ridden out to hear the men's confessions and was waiting by the side of a ditch some distance from the road. Silently, one by one, their rifles slung, the IRA went to him and then returned to the ranks. Soon the priest came back on the road. In a low voice he spoke. Are the boys going to attack the Sassenach, Tom? Yes, Father, we hope so. He questioned no further questions and he said in a loud voice, Good luck, boys. I know you will win. God keep ye all. Now I'll give you my blessing. He rode away into the darkness of the night. The column started its march against the lashing rain. Everyone was drenched, but the march continued by road, by roads, and cross country. Noiseless, silent, and only smoking in the cover of a ditch during the short rest halts, no one knew of its passing as it went towards Kilmichael. During a rest halt, when the column was 3 miles from its destination, Flyer 9 came up from the rear section to report that young Pat Deasy had followed the column all the way and was now 50 yards behind the last section. Pat, a lad of 16 years old, was already battalion lieutenant of signalling in the Bandon battalion. Quiet and serious beyond his years, he was still a merry boy and a favourite with all the column. His enthusiasm for volunteer work and training was exceptional, and when all others were tired out, he could be seen practising arms drills outside his billet. He had been ill for 2 days previously, and before we left, I had told him that he would have to miss the fight. He was instructed to hand over his rifle and equipment to a local man selected to take his place in the column. He was also told to return to Bandon Battalion area until he would be recalled in a week or two. Now here he was again after trailing the column to within 3 miles of the ambush position. Flyer 9 was ordered to bring him forward, and Pat was asked most formally, "Lieutenant DC, you have disobeyed orders. Why?" "No, Commandant. Honestly, I haven't. I can go back to Bandon area this way, but I thought if you saw I was able to march with you, the column would let me wait for the fight. I am not sick. I could march twice as far again without a stop." It was difficult to resist the plea in Pat's voice. It sounded as if his boyish pride was hurt terribly, so he was given back his rifle and his deputy sent home. The column reached the ambush position at 8:15 a.m. as the late winter dawn crossed the sky. The ambush area was in the centre of a bleak and barren countryside, a bogland interspersed with heather and rocks. It was bad terrain for an ambushing unit because of the lack of roadside ditches and cover, but the column had to attack in some part of this road between Kilmichael Cross and Glen Cross of the Three Roads, a few miles to the south. The column could not engage the auxiliaries on the Macroom side of Kilmichael, as enemy reinforcements could quickly arrive from their base. It could not select a position south of the Glen because on the previous 4 Sundays, the terrorists had diverged from Glen Cross to 4 different districts. There was no certainty of meeting them, except on the road between Kilmichael and Glen, which they never once failed to travel. The point of this road chosen for the attack was 1.5 miles south of Kilmichael. Here, the north-south road surprisingly turns west-east for 150 yards and then resumes its north-south direction. There were no ditches on each side of the road, but a number of scattered rocky eminences of varying sizes. No house is visible except one, 150 yards south of the road at the western entrance to the position. It was on this stretch of road it was hoped to attack the auxiliaries. Before being posted, the whole column was paraded and informed of the plan of attack. They were also told that the position they were about to occupy allowed of no retreat. The fight could only end in the smashing of the auxiliaries or the destruction of the flying column. There was no plan for a retirement until the column marched away victoriously. This would be a fight to the end, and would be vital not only for West Cork, but for the whole nation. If the auxiliaries were not broken that day in their first fight with the Irish Army, then the suffering and degradations of the Irish race would surely continue until another generation arose. The auxiliaries were killers without mercy. If they won, no prisoners would be brought back to Macroom. The alternative now was kill or be killed. See to it that those terrorists die and are broken. All the positions were pointed out to the whole column so that each man knew where his comrades were and what was expected of each group. The dispositions and details of the plan were: 1. The command post was situated at the extreme eastern end of the ambuscade and facing the oncoming lorries. It was a small, narrow wall of bare stones, so loosely built that there were many transparent spaces. It jutted out onto the northern side of the road, a good enfilading position but affording little cover. Behind this little stone wall were also 3 picked fighters, John Flyer 9, Clonakilty, Jim Spud Murphy, also of Clonakilty, and Mick O'Herlihy of Union Hall. The attack was to be opened from here, and under no circumstances, whatever, was any man to allow himself to be seen until the commander had started the attack. Number 1 section of 10 riflemen was placed at the back slope of a large heather-covered rock, 10 feet high, about 10 yards from the command post. This rock was a few yards from the northern edge of the road. By moving up the crest of the rock as soon as the action commenced, the section would have a good field of fire. Number 2 section of 10 riflemen occupied a rocky eminence at the western side, entrance to the ambush position on the northern side of the road. and about 150 yards from number one section. Because of its actual position at the entrance, provision had to be made so that some of the men of this section could fire on the second lorry, if it had not come round the bend when the first shots were fired at the leading lorry. Seven men were placed so that they could not fire if the lorry had come round the bend, and three if it had not yet reached it. Michael McCarthy was placed in charge of this section. 4. Number 3 section was divided. Stephen O'Neill, the section commander, and 6 riflemen occupied a chain of rocks about 50 yards south of the road. Their primary task was to prevent the auxiliaries from obtaining fighting positions south of the road. If the auxiliaries succeeded in doing this, it would be extremely difficult to dislodge them. But now O'Neill and his men would prevent such a possibility. This section was warned of the great danger of their crossfire hitting their comrades north of the road and ordered to take the utmost care. 5. The remaining 6 riflemen of the number 3 section had to be used as an insurance group. There was no guarantee the enemy would not include 3 or 4 more lorries. Some riflemen, no matter how few, had to be ready to attack any lorries other than the first two. These men were placed 60 yards north of the ambush position, about 20 yards from the roadside. From here, they could fire on a stretch of 250 yards of the approach road. 2 unarmed scouts were posted at 152 yards. All the positions were occupied at 9 a.m. when up the road came John Lorden with his rifle at the trail. He had heard that the column was looking for action, and he had followed it. Now he asked if he could take part, and was posted to number 2 section. John was the vice OC of the Bandon Battalion, a fine type of volunteer officer and a splendid fighter. He was a welcome addition to the flying column. The column had no food. There was only one house nearby, and although these decent people sent down all of their own food and a large bucket of tea, there was not enough for all. The men's clothes had been drenched by the previous night's rain, and now it was intensely cold as they lay on the sodden heather. Except for a few visits to the section, there was nothing to do but wait, think, and shiver in the biting cold. The hours passed slowly. Towards evening, the gloom deepened over the bleak Kilmichael countryside. Then at last, at 4 or 5 p.m, the distant scout signalled the enemy's approach. So, there was a big section there that I left out that I'll cover next week, which was the strategic positioning that Tom Barry and his team picked out and the column picked out. But this is incredibly powerful stuff, and it's something that I want to cover more and more. So today was just an introduction to what I want to do, how I'm going to do it. Every week from now on is going to focus on either an ambush, a person, or a book. So next week I'm going to go through the Kilmichael ambush from several different perspectives, including the fallout from it. And then we're going to cover Crossbarry, Upton, Taureen, Clonmult, and a lot of others. In some episodes I'm going to bunch a couple of the ambushes together, just because they were smaller engagements, but no less important. When it comes to the books, I've got a large collection of Irish history books there that I want to go through in detail. Some of them are a collection of stories from those who fought for Ireland's freedom, and also taking from the Bureau of Military History, which was a selection of interviews conducted years after the Civil War had finished, and it gave an awful lot of first-hand accounts of people, not only those with a gun in their hand, but also those who passed information and things like that. And I've got a couple of guests lined up too, some very, very interesting people who've got an incredible depth of knowledge in Irish history. So I'm looking forward to getting this going, getting it kick-started. So this is the first one, obviously. Like I was saying, I have absolutely no experience podcasting. If there's anything you'd like to hear about in any detail or anything at all, any feedback, I'll greatly appreciate it. Please reach out through the Instagram. And until next week, thank you for listening to Rebel Tales.